story. You probably heard that before. History is Jesus' story. And let's keep that in the forefront of our mind as we study about all of these different events in the years of silence. So let's begin. And as we begin here, I want to start by reviewing our 17 Bible periods. At this point, we have wrapped up our study of the return from captivity. Then we looked at some passages in Daniel prophesying about events that would happen in the latter part, in the second half, basically, of the years of silence. But so that's where we are. We've got through the return from captivity. We're now officially entering into the years of silence. So it's good to just stop and look at the big picture of all of the periods of the Bible. So please feel free to say these. Don't mumble them. Please feel free to say them, you know, out loud so I can hear you. What is the first Bible period? All right. Creation, or as we call it, before the flood, which is creation and Adam and Eve in the garden and Cain and Abel. Then we have what Bible period?
The flood.
All right. Obviously, next is the flood, and then? Scattering. All right. After the flood is the rest of the Bible, right, Terry? Terry has three Bible periods. So the third one is the scattering of the people. Then what? What's next? All right. Then we have the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And then Joseph goes down to Egypt. So what's the next period? The Exodus. And they come out of Egypt, make forward progress till they get to the Kadesh Barnea and send in the 12 spies. And what period is next? The wandering in the wilderness. And they wander for 40 years, but they don't wander forever. And so eventually they get back on track. And what's the next period? The invasion and conquest of Canaan. You know, leadership of Joshua. They go in and they conquer. They take the land. Joshua dies. The people fall into sin. And then they are basically delivered from all their troubles by the hands of what? People.
Judges.
The judges, the deliverers. Okay, so we have the period of the judges. The time of the last judge, who was Samuel, the people said, we don't want a judge, we want a king. And so what do we have next? We have the United Kingdom. It's united for a while under Saul, David, and Solomon. And then what happens next? It divides because of the idolatry of Solomon and the rebellion of his son. And so we have the divided kingdom for couple of hundred years, and then the northern kingdom is more wicked than the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom is taken away, and what period does that leave us with?
Judah alone.
Judah follows suit and is also wicked. Judah goes into captivity, so that's the period of captivity, right? Babylonian captivity, 70 years, and then eventually that time is over, and what do we have next? The return from captivity. They rebuild the temple, they rebuild the walls, but they don't ultimately rebuild their hearts. They return to the land, but they don't ultimately return to the Lord. And therefore, we have the next period, which is the years of silence. All right. God is silent for 400 years until he finally communicates again with his people regarding the coming of his son. So we have what period? We have the life of Christ. Okay. And one of the reasons Jesus came, of course, was to die on the cross. But another one was to establish the church. So what's the next period?
Early church.
The early church. And then the last period is not really a period, but it's more of a category. During the days of the early church, men like Peter and Paul and others wrote
letters
to the Christians. So there are your 17 Bible periods. I think those are so important to know. And so obviously the one we're focusing in on is right there, the years of silence. It was prophesied in Amos chapter 8. Amos prophesied, "Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord God, when I will send a famine on the land, not a famine for bread or a thirst for water, but rather for hearing the words of the Lord. People will stagger from sea to sea, and from the north even to the east. They will go to and fro to seek the word of the Lord, but they will not find it." It seems to me that that is a prophecy of these 400 years of silence that we're about to study, where God, basically, he was fed up. He had tried communicating with his people. He had sent his prophets. He wanted them to hear him, but they wouldn't hear him. They didn't want a relationship with him. And so his attitude was, okay, if you're not going to hear my message, then I'm going to stop giving you my message. And there will be a famine for hearing the words of the Lord. I think silence like this. It's like when you're watching a play and the curtains close between scenes. And it looks like nothing's going on from the audience's perspective. But behind the scenes, there's frantic activity, and they're setting up the next scene. So that when the curtains open again, it's an all-new scene, right? And so the years of silence, these 400 years, if you lived during that time, you might think, well, God's not doing anything. He's not communicating. He's not seeing his prophets. But behind the scenes, God was working in his providence to help orchestrate the events of history to ultimately lead to the new scene when the curtains would open, and that was the coming of his son. Brian mentioned in one of his classes pretty recently that we today are also living in years of silence. After the days of the first century, God has not sent prophets. We don't have any more divine revelation. We don't have any more inspired writings after the end of the first century. To us, it might look like when you're sitting there watching a play and the curtains are closed. And you go, well, nothing's happening. God, you're not doing anything. Well, God's behind the scenes and he's working. And he is helping to orchestrate things so that finally when the curtains open again, the new scene, of course, will be the return of Jesus and the destruction of this world and the judgment of mankind. So just keep that in mind, that just because God is not today actively sending prophets and giving us inspired writings, that does not mean that he's not busy and that his son is not busy. They are. All right. Jack, I'm sorry. You had a comment earlier.
Overlooked when they're talking about years of silence. They were not silent. They were looking right. for the Messiah, and they right. were told that they would not die before they saw the Messiah.
That's a good point.
So I guess that would be the official marker of when God started communicating again. Yeah. And you've made that point. I think that's a great point. Of course, Brian will have maybe the opportunity to get more into that later because he'll actually be covering that portion of the years of silence. But I think that's a good point. As we study this section of history, the main sources of information that we get for the events of history that were happening are 1st and 2nd Maccabees and the Jewish historian Josephus. All right? So just wanted to kind of make that point. Now, there are a lot of things in the New Testament that the years of silence help explain. There are a lot of details that you don't read about in the Old Testament that all of a sudden from Malachi to Matthew, there's been some changes, and you open the pages of your New Testament and there's a lot of things that are very, very different. What are some of those things? And by the way, our study of the years of silence will help us to understand how those things happen and developed. But what are some of the things that are different in the New Testament than what we saw in the Old Testament?
Okay. A militant observation of the Sabbath day?
Absolutely. A militant observation of the Sabbath day. To the point that the Jews were, wanting to kill Jesus for healing a man on the Sabbath. Do you remember in the Old Testament, the prophets could hardly get the Jews to observe a holy day at all. Or to keep a Sabbath day at all. And then in the New Testament, they're very strict in that. That's a good one. Very good. Jason?
Well, I wasn't going to say about that, but on that point is, but they weren't strict in terms of the substance behind the
observance. Yeah, that's a good point.
So they became very ritualistic
right.
in the New Testament. And it's kind of like they finally understood that the prophets were telling them, you can't be doing that.
Yeah.
But then they did. But the point I'm going to make, the difference in the New Testament, one of the big differences was that Rome existed.
Absolutely.
And the world was a different place. I mean, we understand that, Christ was predicted to come in the fullness of time. Well, part of that fullness of time was what was called the Pax Romana. There was a peace because of the Roman Empire.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah, and I was going to bring that up. So you kind of touched on two things. You were piggybacking on what Terry had said. So in Matthew 23:23, Jesus said, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint, dill, and cumin, but have neglected the weightier matters of the law." Mint, dill, and cumin were herbs. They were tithing herbs. Like everything, they wanted to give one-tenth to God. That's how scrupulous they were and how careful they were. Whereas in the Old Testament, they wouldn't even pay enough tithes to be able to support the priests to do their work in the temple, and the priests had to go look for work elsewhere. You see that difference. But of course, the Pharisees were neglecting the weightier matters of the law, and so it didn't matter how scrupulous they were, how detailed they were. But as Jason also mentioned, you have Rome, the preeminence of Rome. Rome was in existence in the Old Testament days, but it was not a world force or a world power at all. Good. What else? What other things are different?
I was going to say.
Yeah, no, please.
I was going to say just the emergence and the dominance of the Pharisees and the Sadducees.
Yes.
As opposed to back with the prophets going, the Pharisees and Sadducees seem to be like the dominant people.
That's right.
Saying what they should be doing.
And they're the major threat against Jesus. They're the real reason he gets put to death on the cross. So, yeah. And on that, Pharisees and Sadducees. We read about Pharisees and Sadducees in the Old Testament? Or zealots? And then there's a fourth group of Jewish sects that is called Essenes. And we don't actually read about those in the New Testament, but they also, all of those Jewish sects developed during the years of silence. Scott?
About the evolution, if you will, of where they worshiped.
Right.
Synagogue came into somewhere in there.
Maybe. Yes, yes, that's a good one. The synagogue worship actually originated during the captivity, but we don't read about synagogue worship in the Old Testament. However, we do know that during the years of silence, that's when synagogue grew in so much popularity that by the days of the New Testament, there's a synagogue in every major city, right? And so that's a great one. Good. Any other stuff? Yes, ma'am?
Change in the priesthood as well? Didn't it become more of a political position?
It did. Rome was really more in control, was in control of that. Yeah, very good. Terry?
At the close of the Old Testament, we see the Jews struggling with their neighbors, with power.
Yeah.
And as the New Testament opens, we see the Jews are very comfortable and there are really no threats to them.
Okay, that's a really good point. I mean, they're just poverty-stricken peasants in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, and they control maybe 25 square miles around Jerusalem. They're just very weak. And then by the days of the New Testament, they're prospering materially. I mean, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they make bank. They're rich and all of that. And just the Jewish people in general were much more prosperous materially, and they were more influential. There were more of them. They not only took up the area called Judea in the New Testament, but also there was an area north of Samaria called what?
Galilee
that was filled with Jews as well. So that's a huge difference. That's very good. Somebody else had their hand up a second ago? Anybody? Brian?
You've got kings over them, like King Herod.
The Herodian family. And there are many characters in the Herodian family that are prominent in the New Testament. And they were still under the control of Rome, but the Herodian family ruled over the Palestine area, and that's something we don't read about in the Old Testament. So, yeah, all sorts of stuff. So I'll just kind of, I think y'all pretty much hit all of the stuff I wanted to mention. There might be one or two here that you didn't. Preeminence of Rome. Here's one. The universal language was Greek. In the Old Testament, Jews didn't speak Greek, but in the New Testament, you have Greek-speaking Jews. I mean, it's the universal, it's like English. Then you have the Septuagint. Translation? What is the Septuagint?
That's
the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. Jesus quoted from it. Other New Testament authors quoted from the Septuagint. Well, it wasn't even in existence in the Old Testament. So that's another one. Jewish strict law keeping. We talked about that. Jewish sects. The Herodian family. Judah in the days of the New Testament is no longer called Judah, but called Judea. The prosperity of Judea, the Jews' relationship with the Samaritans. That's another one we could kind of talk about. In the Old Testament, you know, in the time of the return, what was the situation with the Samaritans? What was the problem?
They were living in the land and they contested the returnees. They attacked them and tried to
do away with them. They're a major threat. In the New Testament, were the Samaritans a threat anymore? They weren't a threat, but there was still hatred and animosity and racism between the Jews and the Samaritans. In the New Testament, they have their own province between Galilee and Judea called Samaria. They didn't have that in the Old Testament. So the years of silence helped us to understand all of that. I mean, all of this is really helpful. Really, really helpful. But again, I want to remind us that our main purpose here is not just to learn some things that are helpful and enlightening, but to see how all of these things point to Jesus. In Galatians 4, Paul said, "But when the fullness of the time came, God sent forth His Son, born of woman, born under the law, that He might redeem those who are under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons." In the fullness of the time. That's a significant phrase. You remember that in Daniel 2 and in Daniel 7, it was prophesied that God would send His kingdom, that God would establish His kingdom in the days of that fourth kingdom, starting from Babylon as the first one. So what would that fourth kingdom be? Rome. And that would be when the settings were just right for God to send His Son and for His Son to be crucified and for His Son's message to spread and for the gospel to be spread to the whole known world. If Jesus had come in the days of Greece or in the days of, before that, in the days of Persia, then God's plan wouldn't have been fulfilled because the time wasn't full yet. So He had to wait till the time was ripe. And so in our studying of these years of silence, we are watching really what God in His providence is helping to cause and to shape to ultimately cause the time to be full and ripe for the sending of His Son. And that's the emphasis that we need to keep in mind. History is His story. Now, I'm about to lecture for a little while, and this is not my forte, and I'm not a history buff either. So, I'm sorry for y'all. I'll pray for y'all that you hang in there. Now, I'm going to enjoy it, and I hope that you'll enjoy it. But before we do that, this is the last chance, okay? Before the end of class, if I have time at that point. Do you have any comments that you'd like to make before we move on? Jack?
Well, the one thing that was left off the list, and
it would have made your little side to your list equal, is the Pax Romana. The Roman peace allowed the gospel to be spread because the people were not set upon by robbers as much in that particular period of time.
Yeah, that's good, Jack. Pax Romana, and there's a lot more, of course, with Rome and what really set the stage for the time to be full that we could have added to that list. So thank you for that. That's a good point. Anything else? Okay, are y'all ready to be lectured to? Here we go. It's not going to be a typical class. We're not going to have as much, you know, practical application, but I do think it's faith building. I really do, and I'm going to help drive that point home at the end. Okay. So we're going to be really focusing on Persia today, and then on Wednesday we'll be really focusing on Greece, and then next Sunday really focusing on Rome, and then next Wednesday really focusing on the Jews and their role in the years of silence. So what we're going to do in studying about Persia really is we need to back up to when Persia first came to power and just remind ourselves, just kind of review the things that happened that we've already been studying. So we don't have to go into any detail here. Persia was already in power when the last book of the Old Testament was written, right? And continued to be in power for about 100 years into the years of silence. All right. So let's back up just to kind of get the full context of everything to the very beginning. We're going to see two columns here at first. We're going to add more columns later. In all, in these four classes, we're going to be looking at four columns. Okay. Today, we'll look at these two and then we'll add a third one. So we have Persia and the Jews. So the first king of Persia was Cyrus. And of course, Cyrus was the one who, he defeated Media, right? And added Media to the Persian Empire. That's why it's called Medo-Persia or Media-Persia. And he also defeated Babylon. He was also the one who issued the return from captivity for all of the people who were in captivity, not just the Jews. All right, we'll talk more about that in just a second. The Jews at this point were already in Babylonian captivity. They had been in captivity for over 60 years because that's when it started. And so at this time is when you have the writing on the wall. Remember that story in Daniel 5? That was when Babylon fell. At this around this time also is when you have Daniel in Daniel 6, Daniel in the lion's den, all of that. The first group of Jews return in 538 BC, in that it after Cyrus issued that decree for them to return. And what did they do when they returned? What was their main goal with this first return? To rebuild the temple. So they started it, then they got discouraged by the Samaritans and they stopped and everything. Who led this first return? Just kind of review. All right, Zerubbabel and Jeshua the high priest. So very good. Then we go back over here to Persia. We have the next king, which is Cambyses. He added Egypt to this already powerful empire of Persia. And then we have Darius the Great, 521 to 486. Darius was great for a lot of reasons. He really strengthened the Persian Empire. But for our purposes, I want to talk about this. He added Greece to the Persian Empire. And so he annexed Thrace and Macedon to belong to Persia. And that looks like a good thing at first. But the Greeks are going to be a real thorn in the side of the Persians. And eventually, of course, they're going to overtake the Persians. And we're just going to see that ball start rolling here. All right, so at this time you have Haggai and Zechariah in Jerusalem telling the people what? Get back to work on the temple. It's been 18 years now. The temple's just been laying dormant. And so they get back to work. They finish the temple in 516. All right? At this point, we're going to add a Greek thread. We're going to add this third thread, this third column here, and we're going to focus. We have three things to look at one time. It's like when you're watching a movie that's got like three plots, you know, and it keeps switching scenes. Only we get to see it all on the screen at the same time, and hopefully that'll help us keep it organized. I had way too much fun putting these slides together, by the way. I mean, I geek out on this. I just enjoy it. So you have Darius the Great continuing as king over Persia, and he suffers a embarrassing and humiliating defeat in Marathon at the hands of the Greeks. So we see already they're proving to be a thorn in the side of the Persians. And in the days of his son, I'll get to that in a second, let me just mention at this point, Greece was not a unified empire. It was just states, small Greek states. And they were unorganized, and eventually that's going to change, and they're going to unify. So we have Xerxes reigning after Darius the Great. Xerxes was married to whom? Esther and a whole bunch of others, right? But Esther became his queen. So he's very significant in the Bible story. Xerxes wanted to avenge the Greeks. He wanted to take vengeance on the Greeks for the defeat that his father had suffered at Marathon. So he goes to Athens and Salamis, and he brings an attack on Athens. Do you remember what kind of success he had in Athens? What happened? We kind of studied about this when we were in the Book of Esther. He destroyed the Acropolis. What was the Acropolis? It was the religious and civic center of the city. It was up on a hill, you know, and everything. He destroyed that. Now, he actually was defeated in the battle. Ultimately, his navy was defeated, and they had to retreat and go back home. But that part of what they did, destroying the Acropolis, was a major victory and really, really angered the Greeks. They never forgave him for destroying their Acropolis. And that laid the foundation for this hatred to really build so that eventually the Greeks would form this united kingdom and overthrow Persia. That's really the beginning of that bitter resentment. You have the events of the book of Esther. There you have a picture of Esther. You never knew what she looked like. Now you do. Now, of course, the first queen was whom? Vashti. Good. And and Xerxes got rid of her. And it was after that that he went on his campaign against the Greeks. He came back in defeat And it is after he returned that Esther was made queen. We know that by looking at the chronology, and we talked about all of that before when we studied the book of Esther. So she's made queen. She was a Jewess who ends up saving the Jews from annihilation. We all remember that story. After Xerxes, you have Artaxerxes Longimanus. Longimanus. Do you remember what Longimanus means?
Long hand.
Long hand. He had one arm longer than the other. And so Artaxerxes Longimanus. Ty studied Latin when he was in his homeschooling. And he learned quite a lot. So I consulted the expert on how to pronounce Longimanus, because that's actually a Latin word. It stands for long-handed, and he said probably Longimanus. So we have an expert opinion there. Now one thing about Longimanus is he had a lot of sons. Anybody remember how many he had from your reading? All right, he had actually 18 sons. One was a legitimate heir, and then 17 sons that were born through concubines, and so that's going to play a role in the story in just a moment. So I wanted to point that out. All right. The Greeks were growing in power at this time, such that they took possession of all of Asia Minor, which is, you know, the area of like modern day Turkey. They took possession of all of that area west of that river right there. It's called the Halys River. So, I mean, they're really growing in power, and that power is just, it's going to rise and wane. It's going to ebb and flow over the next several decades. But at this moment, they have a lot of power. All right. It is at this time that we have the second and third return from captivity while Longimanus is reigning. Second return was led by whom? Ezra, who, you know, taught the people, and it was all about building the people up spiritually. And then this third return was whom?
Nehemiah.
That was Nehemiah, who came to do what?
Rebuild
the walls of Jerusalem. And by the way, Longimanus was the king that Nehemiah served as cupbearer to. He was the actual king. So there was favor. When you have Xerxes and Longimanus, there is favor at this time with the Jewish people, right? Then we have Malachi, the last prophet of the Old Testament. He wrote in about 430, some say 432, but it's somewhere in there. And really, what was Malachi's message? We studied Malachi recently. Remember the main message? Malpractice in worship. The point was, you people have failed to reverence God. And as a result of that, Malachi prophesied, the messenger of the covenant is coming, but in other words, you have failed me. That was kind of the message. In fact, the last word of Malachi, I believe, is the word curse. Like, it's a very negative message. That's how the Hebrew Old Testament ends, at least as it's organized in our English Bibles. But even in the Hebrew Bible, Malachi is the last of the prophets, and they don't like the fact that the word curse is the last word. So after they read that, they'll go back and read an earlier part that doesn't have the curse. But, you know, ends on a really bad note. And it is after Malachi that the years of silence begin. So that was my introduction for our study of the years of silence with Persia. We'll pause just for a moment. I know that was a lot to soak in. We've already studied all that stuff, so it's mostly just a review. But does anybody have any questions? I may or may not be able to answer them. Or any comments? Okay.
All right.
Very good. Now we move on. And we're going to now look at the events in the next 100 years as Persia continues as the world power. Now we are in the years of silence. God is no longer communicating with his people, no longer sending his prophets. So the sixth king of Persia was Xerxes II. He ruled for all of 45 days. And he was killed by one of his 17 brothers, which was Sogdianus. Sogdianus ruled for a long time, 6 months. He was killed by a brother. You know, sometimes my kids don't get along. And I'll jokingly say, stop killing each other. Well, these brothers were, they were literally killing each other. Then you have Darius II, and he reigns for almost 2 decades. Now, at this time, the Persian kingdom had really weakened in its power. It did not have the brute force and strength that had really propelled it to the world stage. There wasn't the loyalty. There was more motivation for Persian gold than anything else. And I mean, the military had weakened, and so things are really starting to go downhill for Persia at this time. After, I wanted to just mention this. The most famous, the most influential of all the Greek philosophers was Socrates, and he was alive at this time. His thinking, as well as Aristotle's and Plato's, and they kind of came after him. Aristotle's life overlapped with his, and then Plato's life overlapped with Aristotle's. Their thinking really influenced the Greek way of living and thinking, and ultimately influenced the world. All right, at this time, the Jews in the land really were prospering. They weren't the poverty-stricken peasants that they were, even at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. At this time, they were already starting to prosper very much. They were also growing increasingly distant from the Gentiles. Now, do you remember who it was in our study, The Return from Captivity, who told the people, you got to divorce these foreign wives you're married to? It was Ezra. And then Nehemiah had to also deal with that. And they were worshiping the false gods of these other nations, and they were intermarrying with the people of these other nations. So it was a very serious thing. You remember what Ezra did? When Ezra was telling, what are y'all doing? Get rid of these women. What did he do? He beat them. He plucked out their hair from their beards, and just really, he was just furious. And so it was this corporal punishment. It seems like after that, they learned their lesson. They never really, the faithful Jews, never really had that problem of just being intermingled with the other nations. They would adopt their culture, but they would not worship their gods. The idolatry was done away with faithful Jews, was done away with all the way back in captivity. So you see this growing distance. The term Gentile, it used to just mean people, right? Like in the Old Testament days. But by the days of the New Testament, what does Gentile mean? Anybody who's not a Jew. Can you imagine that? The Jewish mind, they divided all mankind into two parts. You know, like Terry divided the Bible into three parts, right? The Jews, they divided all humanity. You've got Jews and you got Gentiles, Greeks, right? Sometimes it's just called Greeks. Then also, I want to mention this, and we already talked about this earlier after Scott's comment. More and more Jewish synagogues were developing during this time as well. All right, so y'all hang with me. Let's come back now to Persia, and we have Artaxerxes Naaman. And by the way, you guys are hanging with me really well. And if you're like me, this stuff is actually really fascinating. It's actually really interesting. Artaxerxes Naaman. What does Naaman mean?
Memory.
Like we have like the word mnemonic device. So it means memory. Why was he called that? You may remember?
He had a great memory.
He had a phenomenal memory. But I guess he didn't have a memory good enough to remember that his brother, who actually was the one that should have had the right to the throne, hated him and wanted to kill him. So his brother's name was Cyrus, and his brother came out and attacked the Persian army at Kunaxa. And although his brother lost that battle, it was a very telling battle because his brother hired 18,000 Greek mercenaries as part of his huge army. That was just a small portion of it. These Greek mercenaries were merciless. They were very effective against the Persian army. And so at this time, the mercenaries, and therefore the Greeks as a whole, were growing in confidence. Now they actually started to think, do we have a chance at overthrowing the Persians? Maybe we do. This is when they start to really have that kind of a goal. All right, now we have Artaxerxes Acus. Acus, he was actually a good king in a lot of ways, but he was poisoned by a general. And then his son was placed on the throne by that same general. Acus has mentioned this. Philip II becomes king of Macedon in 359. Who is Philip II? That's Alexander the Great's dad, okay? He becomes king over the Greeks in the same year that Acus begins his reign. And Philip hates the Persians. Oh, he hates the Persians. Then we have Arses. This is the son of Acus. That same general that killed Acus put on the throne thinking, I can control him. Well, when he started showing signs of actually thinking for himself, then the general decided, I'll kill him too, and put another man on the throne whose name was Darius. Big surprise. Darius the Third. I think the fact that this general is like just putting kings on the throne is indicative that the Persian Empire at this point is kind of a little pitiful. It's not the great force that it once was. The situation is getting sad. And they're about ready to fall. And that's when we're going to see Alexander the Great destroying them. In the same year that Darius III began his reign, you have Philip of Macedon being assassinated. He had done a good job at collating these Greek states and, you know, uniting them. And his goal was to overthrow Persia, and he was on the path to do that. But then he was assassinated, and his son, Alexander the Great, I think he was maybe 20, had this, you know, responsibility, this role of leadership placed in his lap. And although Alexander the Great was great and he was a genius, the stage had already been set for the overthrow of Persia. And it was right. That's part of why he was so successful at spreading the Greek Empire so quickly. The ball had been rolling for many, many years by the time he took over as king. Once we start studying him, however, that's a new thread that we're going to focus on. Well, not a new thread, but we're going to focus on Greece as the main empire on Wednesday, as I said. I got through that faster than I meant to because I wanted to make sure that I didn't just run out of time. So I covered it all, but now we have a few minutes. So I want to bring this back to our main emphasis. History is his story. It is really amazing to me to think about the fact that, yes, we see all these events happening and we get kind of caught up in all the kings and all the intrigue and the backstabbing and all the stuff that's going on. And we might lose focus of the fact that God is behind the scenes. The curtains are closed, but God is behind the scenes, and he's helping to orchestrate these things so that when the fullness of the time comes, he will send forth his son. To me, that is really, really, really faith-building to see how God is working in all of this. So I wanted to open up we've got 4 minutes, so y'all are going to have to do some talking. Sorry. Comment on how this is helpful for you, history being Jesus' story, or on anything else we talked about. Any comments or questions? Dan?
As far as Persia, were all the other, like Rome, was Rome kind of like that with the names, where the first name was taken after a father, and then the last name seems to come from like an Indian name, like what they were good at, you know, sort of thing.
Yes.
Has that always been, and is that just Persia, or is that Rome? Is that the rest of them? That
it's typical. Okay. Yeah, like the term Caesar, that wasn't like a first name. It was like a kingly title. So you have Caesar Augustus. You had a lot of other Caesars. And, you know, Brian, you might can comment on that. I don't know. Do you have anything to add? Yeah, there you go. So, yes, to answer your question, that was very typical. Very typical.
So,
So I guess how does that differ from the apostles? They were just a different culture sort of thing? Because the apostles, they always went by two different names. And then you always had to figure out who are they talking about now?
Right.
Who are they talking about now? And that's always been the confusion with them.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm trying to link them somehow, but maybe there is no link or whatever. They're just two different cultures. They go about things differently.
Yeah, I think it's a little different just because with the kings, it was like their official title. But sometimes they did have like a nickname attached, like Artaxerxes Longomenus or Naaman. You know, you have Peter, who was also given the name by the Lord, Simon, right? Or it was Simon who was given the name Peter, which means rock, right? So that was kind of like a nickname that was given to him by the Lord. And then often people would have a name where they would be called after their father. They didn't have last names, but sometimes like son of would be like their last name. That's a good question. All right, good. Any other comments, questions? Terry?
It's interesting how Greek philosophy, even in the present world that we live in now, is kind of prevalent. And it's interesting how Philip hired Socrates to tutor Alexander the Great, and how that Greek philosophy was, you know, permeated the world at that time, was through Alexander the Great being under the tutelage of Socrates.
Yeah, that is so, and we'll get into more of that on Wednesday. And yeah, I mean, even a lot of our modern day thinking can trace this back to these events. It's very eye opening. Good. Y'all got less than a minute. Any other comments? You guys have been kind. Y'all didn't leave me up here hanging. Anything else? Don't leave me hanging. I got more than 30 seconds to go. Jack?
I left one other thing off the Roman thing. There's a sermon from, I don't remember now who the man was, but was that the roads were very good. Some of the Roman roads exist today.
Yes.
They haven't covered them over because they were good enough for use.
Yeah, and Brian will get to talk about that. The Roman road system, you know, we even have today the saying, all roads lead to Rome, was very intricate and very effective, and it played a big role in the spreading of the gospel to the whole world, you know, the Great Commission. And so that's another factor in the fullness of the time. Yeah, it's exciting stuff. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's so fascinating and faith building. All right, guys. Please read through page 134A for Wednesday.